Mr. Evans, thank you so much for speaking with me. I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself, tell me a little bit about your professional background and how you got involved in the project in Lithuania.
Gord Evans. Going back, I worked for the Canadian and then Ontario governments over the period of about 20 years. My last position was in cabinet office. I was in cabinet office for 8 years, and for about 4 years of that, I had an obscure title called Deputy Clerk of the Executive Council. Basically, that position was coordinating the planning across government and sitting in on cabinet and taking the minutes for cabinet decisions. In 1998, I left the government, went into international work, and fell into two jobs, one in China and one in Lithuania. The Lithuanian job, which of course we're talking about now, was a project funded by CETA. It was a partnership between the Ontario Public Service, IPAC, which is an NGO, the Public Administration Association in Canada, and the Lithuanian government. So that began my international career. It was not a full-time job. I would go to Lithuania quite frequently, like maybe once a month, for over a period of 4 or 5 years, and have continued since then doing work in about 25 different countries internationally, most of it on central government.
Mm-hmm. What was the aim of the project in Lithuania?
Well, it's interesting. There's different perceptions about that. From the Ontario government's perspective, the aim was to go over there and to introduce business planning. And in Ontario at that time, business planning was a type of strategic planning where basically the way in which ministries plan their budgets is linked to the policies, which is linked to the government priorities, you know, sort of classic strategic planning type of approach. In the Lithuanians' mind, it was varied things. And probably because they were used to donors, they thought it was part of public administration reform. And, you know, which in that, at that particular period of time, there was all these public admin reform strategies being developed across Eastern Europe and places like that. And so there wasn't quite a real understanding. I mean, the people involved in the Canadian side were not development professionals. They were all people in government. So from our perspective, we didn't have a clue what public admin reform was because no normal government would ever do that. But, you know, from the donor side, this was very, very complicated. So it took a while to actually work out what it was about.
Mm-hmm. So did you diagnose the different problems then? Did you have one agenda and the local officials you were working with perhaps had a different agenda?
Yeah. Well, I think the reason for some of the misunderstanding is it was diagnosed by a senior Canadian civil servant who went over there and talked to the Prime Minister. And the problems the Prime Minister articulated...
This is Prime Minister Bagnorius.
Yeah, Bagnorius. We're very closely connected with decision-making systems and how budgets were utilized and, you know, issues like that. Whereas our home base, we were put reporting to the Ministry of Public Administration Reform and local authorities, which was known by the acronym MPARLA. Their job was to implement this public and then reform strategy across government. So they saw these other issues as being outside their competence, which was true, and nothing they could deal with, whereas what we thought we were doing, you know, and understanding the Prime Minister, was something that was connected to the Prime Minister's office. So naturally what happened over time is we gravitated towards the Prime Minister's office, although still being in MPARLA. Mm.
At this point, did you have the support of the officials at MPARLA? Did you explain your perception, your diagnosis, and your understanding of what the Prime Minister in fact wants out of this program? And did MPARLA come on board?
Yeah, and you know, this was explained, and it wasn't that MPARLA, you know, opposed it so much. It was just that they saw it as gains outside their competence. So they tried to support it, but they were always kind of leery about how much they would be able to accomplish using this particular thing. I remember this time there was dozens of projects everywhere, and you know, people didn't necessarily take them all that seriously, depending on what it was. So
I understand reform didn't really move forward in 1998-99 under Prime Minister Bagnorius. Can you explain why?
Yeah. You know, it didn't. I mean, again, these types of, like, center government reforms only work if the top, you know, the Prime Minister is committed to doing it, basically, and if he delegates to his most senior officials, you know, the responsibility for driving the thing. So, although we had a connection in the Prime Minister's office during this first period, I'm talking about a year and a half, from mid-98 to the end of 99, And he kept it alive in a sense, because he saw, a young guy, he saw the value of it, so he kept it alive in the Prime Minister's office, but he wasn't able to, you know, put it on, in a sense, that Prime Minister's agenda. So then, you know, of course, it started taking off in early 2000 when Prime Minister Kibilius came to power, because he'd already been to Canada, already seen the system, knew what he wanted, and in January 2000, just after Kibilius came into power, I came to Lithuania and said to the new chancellor, or not chancellor, head of the government office, Mr. Šemeta, that the project had to move into the chancellery, prime minister's office, or it wouldn't work. And they did that. So then it shifted to the prime minister's office.
Mm-hmm. We discussed some of the context in which Lithuania is acting in 2000, the EU accession, the Russian financial crisis. But on a smaller scale, what were the more limited, the specific goals of the reform program?
Again, the goals didn't change. I mean, it was to sort of introduce this business or strategic planning system across government. We had pilots in three ministries, in justice, economy, and Parla itself. But again, unless a system like that is adopted across government, it's just a lot of work and you're running a parallel system. So that's another reason it wasn't working in the early days. When it got its second life, in early 2000 under Kibilius, again, the objectives didn't change. It's just the level at which it was being delivered did change. It was coming from the Prime Minister and coming from the Prime Minister's office.
Were there other lessons to be learned from the pilot stage?
Just those, that if you do, okay. You know, the classic ones, if you don't have support from the top, it's kind of a waste of time. And you can't just export a Canadian system into a system that doesn't want it or isn't ready for it.
Yeah. What were the specific problems that business planning were meant to solve?
Number one, making sure your resources are aligned with your commitments, which of course sounds easier than it is. Making sure that your resources are devoted to the government's priorities, which again sounds easier than it is. And secondly, that the ministry is organized in a way that it can actually implement these plans once it occurs. There's a big emphasis, because functional reviews were very popular in Eastern Europe at the time too. There was sort of some pressure on us to get involved in a big functional review exercise, which we didn't really see as being a valuable use of time. And I think in retrospect, that was a good decision.
So when was the strategic planning working group first formed?
Sorry?
When was the strategic planning working group first formed?
Yeah. Almost right away. I mean, the 2000, I remember Kibilius was just in power for about a year, and it shows how quickly things can actually occur with the right leadership. And basically, we talked to the Prime Minister and Mr. Šemeta, who was head of the government office, spent about 5 hours with them at Prime Minister Kibilius' house, going through exactly how the system would work, shaped it into something to work in Lithuania. The next week, we introduced it at cabinet and to some senior managers. The next week, he appointed his chancellor, which is head of the Prime Minister's office, as head of a working group to design the methodology. This is probably in February or so, January, February. On that group were all like some senior officials from government, like the vice minister from the Ministry of Finance, a couple technical people, some of the Prime Minister's office, two or three line ministries, a couple of senior people from Imparla. So it was a fairly high-level group to be doing what seemed like a technical exercise, but he recognized that if they didn't get it, you know, if it wasn't buy-in by these people and they didn't understand the system, it wouldn't get implemented and it wouldn't be suitable for Lithuania. So basically, we all worked together very intensively late at night over a period of a month or so to come up with the design of the system, and it was actually implemented that year. Mm-hmm. So there was a full cycle. It was decided not to test it, just to implement it. So there was a full planning cycle from March onwards, really, that implemented the new system. Every ministry produced a plan that year, priorities were set, all the various steps of the process were followed in 2000.
Was there did you develop a methodology that you implemented in the pilot stage as well? Was this substantially different?
It followed the same kind of, well, the difference was is what we were implementing in the pilot stages were really just plans and ministries, but since the plans weren't connected with either the budget process or any kind of priorities at government, they kind of were just, you know, isolated instruments. Whereas this time, I mean, the process began as it should, with the government setting priorities and then it flowing through the budget process, setting the macroeconomic framework and the fiscal parameters, the budget ceilings, and flowing from there into detailed planning. So, you know, the difference was in the first stage, it was simply an exercise, really, to produce some plans that were disconnected from reality. In the second stage, it was driven by political decisions. So mm-hmm. It's night and day.
Do you recall anything about the meeting at the Prime Minister's house? Was there an aha moment when he...
Well, no, because it was so long. It wasn't like an aha moment. Because I'd known the Prime Minister from before, I'd worked with him on a couple of things when he was the Deputy Speaker of Parliament. He came to Ontario on basically one of the study tours and got to see the system in action. I already knew him. And so, again, it was in a five-hour meeting, it wasn't like, as I said, an aha moment. It was much more practical about what would work in Lithuania. How could we do it? What would be the choreography of staging it? Mm-hmm. If there was a moment, is my coworker, Ann Evans, no relation, basically, so we did bring a slide, like a printout of a PowerPoint presentation, which we didn't put on the table. But when conversation got to a certain point, we did say, well, we do have these slides, and that allowed us to get into it in a bit more detail. So that turned out to have been a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, that perhaps leads to the next question, which is, as someone very familiar with a Canadian model of strategic planning, what are some of the challenges in trying to introduce a model, explain the model, but let the locals take ownership and adapt it to their own context?
Yeah. In a sense, it was made a lot easier because, as I said, the Prime Minister had already been to Canada, and he understood it, and he, in his mind, had already adapted it, and we worked out how to adapt it before it was even introduced. So, the number one person that's important to convince is already convinced and has a vision of how it should work. It took a little longer with the rest, but the main thing was is they didn't ask Anne and I to go out and design something and bring it back to them. Is they designed it themselves. I mean, there's a set of principles, and we were involved in the committee, so, you know, if they were sort of going off track, we would sort of bring them back on track. But essentially, they designed the whole thing themselves based on their, you know, with finance, based on their system. They're also, it's worth noting, had been implementing a program budgeting system since 1998, so that system got tied in with this.
Are there any, in your opinion, unique features of the Lithuanian system? Or ways in which it was uniquely tailored to match the Lithuanian administrative culture?
Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest difference between the Lithuanian system and most other systems, although it is very common in Eastern Europe, is it's incredibly legalistic. So there's a massive volume of laws that have to be dealt with. So in a sense, the notion of proceeding with policies is quite foreign. So the breakthrough that has to occur is when you're in a normal system, you would set some strategic goals and objectives, and then you would produce some policies to deliver those goals and objectives. Here, it ends up with a mass of laws with no policy instrument. So they had to make, in a sense, the conceptual leap to understand how strategic goals and objectives could be delivered through a mass of legal instruments. And that remains to some degree a struggle to this day. But, you know, that would probably be the biggest major adaptation. Mm-hmm. It's a coalition government, too, but then, you know, lots of European countries have coalition governments. It's not totally fun. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that the working group is meeting late January, February, mm-hmm. And that you unrolled the program already that year. So did the government manage to make a macroeconomic forecast and issue guidelines to my ministries in 2000, I remember at one point.
Yeah, the new timetable. And remember, I mean, to some degree, they were implementing this as a test, outside the legal framework. And the legal framework was just the budget law, which had a different series of dates in mind. And again, to a very, in a very, very legalistic system, this sort of caused some people to sort of reflect, you know, should we really be doing this? But Prime Minister said, why not? You know, we don't, you know, we'll get the budget to time this, you know, into the Parliament, so that's fine. So, you know, he kind of got around that problem. But basically, yeah, because we start in January, the macroeconomic framework gets prepared in March and is ready by late March, early April. So the methodology had been developed by then. Instructions had been developed for ministries by then. Strategic planning coordinators in each ministry were appointed by then. So you did have the basic sort of institutional infrastructure ready to actually go through with the full process. Mm-hmm.
Did you, was there a communication strategy to the line ministries? Did you support the training for strategic planning officers?
I mean, it wasn't sophisticated because it was a process. But some things were done that hadn't been done before. You know, sort of, there was sort of, you know, I guess you'd call them workshops or something where people at the Prime Minister's office, the Chancellery, the Ministry of Finance would chair a meeting with also the ministry representatives, like the heads of the budget department or the heads of their strategic planning units, you know, and talk about the methodology, talk about expectations, that kind of thing. And remember, at the political level, the Prime Minister set up the Strategic Planning Committee, which was, you know, sort of a small cabinet committee, it's an offshoot of cabinet, to sort of oversee the process. Is it chaired by himself? Co-chair of the Ministry of Finance with some senior ministers on it, and they took an active role in the process throughout as well. But the big thing is just for the ministries is they saw that the political leadership cared about it, and that was the major message, so they took it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about the role of the Strategic Planning Committee?
Yeah. It's, you know, again, as I said, you know, in cabinet systems, they often create cabinet committees. Because you don't want, you can't, you know, the agenda of cabinet is too vast to deal with any particular issue in depth at the cabinet meeting. So this particular sort of subcommittee of cabinet, you know, I think I had about six members, so the Prime Minister, Minister of Finance, and some senior ministers. And those meetings would last 2 to 3 hours, and they would look at an issue in depth. So they, for instance, would approve the macro framework, approve the strategic priorities, you know, look at the budget ceilings, look at the ministry's strategic plans, like the key points in the process, they would get together and approve things. Now, when I say approve things, in a cabinet system, they don't, they approve them in principle. They still have to go to the full cabinet, still have to be debated with the full cabinet and approved by the full cabinet. So it wasn't as though all the other ministers were ultimately excluded. But certainly the key ministers were probably driving the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. So you've discussed it a bit already, but I'd like to ask about the role of the Ministry of Finance in this process. So that, to some extent, reforms were initiated in the Prime Minister's office.
Yeah. I mean, this role was clearly driven by the Prime Minister's office. In a lot of systems, you have sort of a dysfunctional at times split between the Ministry of Finance is doing and what the rest of what the Prime Minister's office and the cabinet are doing. You know, the budget process goes on and on its own little merry way, and then the policy and legal process goes on in a different way. What this attempted to do was to bring the key steps in the budget process, which is setting the macro framework, the setting of ceilings, allocating monies to priorities, making sure plans match budget ceilings, bring that together with the government planning process. The Ministry of Finance at first was extremely skeptical, and, you know, to some degree, I suppose, didn't necessarily ever fully buy in, but they did seem to realize at a certain point that there's some advantage in having the Minister of Finance and the Prime Minister present a united front to the other ministers about what the priorities were and about the respecting the budget ceilings and not making budget requests that were double the amount available. And so I think they did see it as sort of, instead of having Mr. Finance happen to fight everybody, it created a better sort of political dynamic for them. And it also allowed them to sort of introduce their program budgeting process within the planning framework, the laws, which is important for implementation. That having been said, there's always constituencies in the Ministry of Finance who just you know, really care about protecting the budget and, you know, in the same way they've delivered it for a million years, and that's probably true to this day.
Mm-hmm. Were there other ministries or other organs of government that opposed the reform process and posed some actual threat to undermine the reforms?
No, not threat. And again, this is the advantage of having the Prime Minister lead it. You know, even in a coalition government, you'd be a fool to blatantly oppose the Prime Minister. The Minister of Defence was at first leery about it, because they've been implementing a sort of a program budgeting system that's all almost like part of NATO. All ministers of defense in Eastern Europe were doing that at this time. And they were worrying that all their work was going to be replaced by a different approach. So, in fact, what the Prime Minister did is they put the Ministry of Defense on the Strategic Planning Committee, like the working group, rather, to make sure that, in a sense, we use some of the work they'd done as a model for the others. So that was the one area that might have been a problem. It was, you know, preempted by involving them.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the priority setting, the importance of priority setting in this context, both in terms of channeling financial resources to priorities, but also something that you've written about, which is the prioritizing important legislation. So if you can describe maybe some of the weaknesses that you found in 1999, 2000, and how those were addressed.
Yeah. I mean, let's just talk about priority setting first. I mean, the first year it was done probably in the most clean way, and it's a sort of a classic ABX budgeting approach, where you set aside an envelope of money for priorities. Decide what they are. You develop, you know, you get some specificity around what you're going to do with that money. This is within the macro framework. And then, so that becomes sort of protected money. And then you create the budget ceilings outside of that. So all the ministries have to find some savings in lower priorities areas to make up for it. That's the X part of the budget. And then the plans, in a sense, reflect those ceilings, you know, minus the budget priorities being an add-on. So that was the first year, and that worked rather well. But I think that was the only year they did that. In future years, it became more muddled, which again is common in many governments. But even in those years, I think the fact you had somewhere in the middle, the Minister of Finance would still set the ceilings, maybe with just a vague list of general priorities. But you did still have the Prime Minister getting involved in sort of the middle of the budget process to try and make sure the things the government cared about did get in the plans and did get some money. And I think under Brazauskas, there was sort of a fair bit of effort to make it happen there. So it's not as clean, but it still has that dynamic of the Prime Minister inserting himself at the right, at a certain point in the process to make sure that the key things are being taken care of. So that was the priority setting side. What was the second part?
Well, about the legislative backlog.
Yeah.
And priority legislation.
And we always knew it was a problem. As part of the World Bank at this point, it started becoming interested in the center of government reforms. Because remember, Lithuania was one of the first center of government reforms anywhere, that had a really focused center of government approach. So we started getting interested in this, and since it was such a problem in Lithuania, we basically set up a study, and I think it was a Dutch trust fund that funded the thing. Anyway, we sort of examined it, and we found that really important laws were getting lost in the parliament, getting lost in the bureaucracy, and they were coming. I think one stat that just horrified them is that 45% of their major European integration laws were 6 months late from their target, and this was affecting their whole ability to get into Europe. And this is something the Prime Minister really wanted to change. So they developed a much more focused legislative approach, where the priority legislation had to come forward. It was tracked in the Prime Minister's office. So basically it was much more hands-on management. And within a year, they flipped it around that I think only about 10% instead of 45% were being late. We also did things like measure how much the Prime Minister's time was going into strategic issues versus administrative issues, and again we managed to flip that from about, I can't remember what it was, but say 30% to about 70%. So there's just, again, these things are easy to do if anyone cares about them, and the right attention is devoted to them. And that's what they did. And so in 1 year, there was a big turnaround on these types of issues. Now, like every system, these problems tend to go away for a while, come back again, and now, you know, here we're in 2012, and they're looking at the same problems again in new ways to deal with them.
Mm-hmm. That first year in 2000, what do you think worked well with the system? What do you think did not work well?
Well, the main thing that you know, if I sort of looked at what worked well, and it would be all the issue of just the political buy-in, because that's what, you know, when you look at reforms in other countries and why they haven't worked, it's because there's been, you know, they always use the phrase political buy-in. We had it here. So that's why it worked. And secondly, that it survived a transition to the Social Democrats, which meant that the two major parties, and the Liberals as well, the three major parties actually, had all experienced with it. So there's no sense, really. I don't think anyone here thinks it's ever going to be thrown out because another type of government is going to get in. Another thing that worked well is it was designed by the Lithuanians. It wasn't, they didn't ask us to go away and write a manual for them. They themselves wrote it, which means that, you know, if they design the manual themselves, they'll fix it themselves. They were already revising the manual, I think, every 2 years they'd revise it because they saw the problems and they'd fix it themselves. And I think we created a, you know, sort of a critical mass of, well-placed people throughout the public administration, including in ministries, that cared about reform, saw it linked to getting into Europe, and saw it as being beneficial to the country, a good way to do business, basically. Mm-hmm. So those would be some of the benefits of it. What didn't work? Again, I don't think, it's not that it didn't work, it's just these things take time. I mean, there's still, to this day, there's a legalistic culture that doesn't lend itself to this type of planning. It's a culture that a work culture that looks at, you know, the way to deal with problems in government are to draft laws, rather than trying to deal with them in sort of more complex manners. And that's an ongoing, that's sort of an ongoing issue. Did we ever get it fully, institutionalized in ministries? Don't know, but that may be, a weakness. But that may also just be a factor of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a different sense, how do you measure the success of strategic planning? You mentioned some of the benefits in terms of prioritization of the government's top priorities, and synchronizing the policy planning process with the budget process. But did you see, though these things can be hard to measure, did you see tangible improvements in the quality of planning, improvements in execution of plans, improvement in the quality and feasibility of budget submissions?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple elements to that. Things. I mean, in a sense, when you say, like, what would be some sort of measures of success, the intangible ones are, in a sense, a breakdown of some of the classic barriers you find in every government. There's a bit of a breakdown of the separation between the Ministry of Finance and the cabinet process. They sort of get together a bit. There's a bit of a breakdown between the isolation between the political level and the administrative level. You start getting more of a mix between them. There's a bit of a breakdown between what happens at the center and in ministries. So I guess, these are the more unmeasurable ones. What I saw is kind of a measure of success is, a gradual weakening of these sort of hardened silos that build up in a lot of governments. And, when I first started, the analyst in the Prime Minister's office who was responsible for finance had never met with the budget director. And now they would, these people talk daily on the phone. In terms of the measurable ones, I mean, strategic planning doesn't guarantee you a great future for your country or anything. It's just really a way to organize, your business. I mean, we developed some measures in those studies and looked at them, and there were significant improvements across a lot of areas. There's significant improvements in terms of how the Prime Minister spent his time. It was more devoted to strategic issues. There's significant improvements in how much delays there were in bringing forward priority issues. there's significant improvements in the budget requests. Instead of being double or triple the money available, they were much more realistic. So there was a whole, and you know, you've got the data, there was four or five distinct areas where there were tangible improvements. And then they seemed to be corroborated in that, you know, 2006 World Bank study where they used a variety of measures to look across these Eastern European countries to look at policy coordination, performance management, strategic planning, and a whole bunch of other measures. And generally, Lithuania and Latvia both came out rather well in that. So, you know, there seemed to be some tangible evidence that these things had had a beneficial effect.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to ask you about, and this has come up in a couple of meetings, and perhaps presents a contrast with Latvia. You mentioned that in 2000, the government introduced the program across the board. They skipped the pilot stage, for example. I've heard some concerns about the rigidity of the process, and perhaps creating more space for ministers or appropriations managers to have some discretion, some flexibility in planning. Did you see an issue here? Do you think that the planning process takes away some of that flexibility?
Yeah, I mean, again, you'd have to actually go out into ministries and see how it's applied there. I mean, if you think about what happens, some priorities are set. That's where the new money goes. Some ceilings are set, they have to be respected. I don't know that ministries really are blocked from bringing forward things, to this day. I mean, they may feel they would like more flexibility to spend more money, but, you know, that's can't really be done, in sort of a disciplined system. So maybe that's just an ongoing tension. I don't know that the methodology was so all pervasive that they wouldn't have had any particular flexibility to pursue their own agendas within their fiscal framework. But that might relate more to the and I don't know this, but that may relate more to the budget process, where you have a very it's complicated to move money around under the budget system. So it might be more to do with that.
Okay. You mentioned one of the successes of the reforms is that it did survive. It was sustained across several governments. Were there things that you or the prime minister, officials in the prime minister's office, did to convince new governments or to help sustain the reforms? Was it partially just luck that the successive prime ministers endorsed it,
or
to what do you attribute the sustainability of reforms?
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, the luck part, I think, the reality is any successful reform, there's a big element of luck. You know, the stars have to align. The obvious luck part was simply getting Prime Minister Kubilius, who was already, already understood in advance and knew what he wanted to do and went to it. In terms of the sustainability, though, I think the keys were that, well, there was still a project there, but this was much more than a project. And although with a new government coming in, the political level was removed, it's a politicized system, all the vice ministers, probably half the vice ministers did come back in similar or different positions. The core of civil servants that had been involved in the system, including some in the chancellery, were still there. So when the new government was there and it was presented to them as something that could be to their benefit, and it's not a planning system is not a partisan thing particularly, and so they continued it. And then first the Paxis Liberals came in. He came in twice. It was Vagnorius, then Paxis, then Kubilius, then Paxis again, and then Brzezowskis, and that was the key one, because the Social Democrats were in power for 6 or 7 years. I think they were a little leery at first about whether this would be any good, but eventually the Prime Minister came around to it, I would attribute it, to just there being, a critical mass of people within the public administration that made the case for it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a bunch of foreigners convincing them.
Mm-hmm. Were there any unforeseen challenges that arose?
Unforeseen? No, to be honest, nothing in particular. We never, we thought the transitions of government, and remember there were rapid transitions of government in those days. I mean, all those governments I just named, with the exception of Brazauskas, they were just in power for anywhere from as little as 6 months to a year. So this constant turnover of prime ministers in a politicized system where you have to let all the vice ministers go and then hire them again, you weren't even getting through full planning cycles. So it wasn't until you got Brazauskas, who was, I guess, re-elected and I think was in power for 5 or 6 years, that you had a chance to actually have the cycle go through more than once under a government. Now, of course, remember, these things have been put in law to some degree, too. So, you know, they always follow their laws. So at least that was there. But, yeah, that was sort of the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. Were there any, you mentioned that the strategic planning unit revised the system at least every 2 years.
Yeah.
Were there any notable changes or revisions that stand out to you?
There's one not so much connected with strategic planning. I mean, strategic planning, you know, they'd have little feedback sessions, and they do to this day with ministries, with you know, and they continually bring new things in. Of course, the big change was when they became a European nation. They then no longer were looking at European integration. They had to figure out how to integrate the whole European dimension of policy into their own planning system. So that was a huge, huge change, and I think they, and that was around when I stopped working in the country, but they brought the European unit into the Chancellery, so there's two parts to it, and I think they made a big effort to make sure that the two streams kind of work well together, at least as well as they could. I mean, Europe has its own, you know, dynamics. So that was one big change. But the other big change, which actually didn't work, was the whole, in 2003, it was just at the end of our project, they tried to introduce impact assessment, which is sort of what Latvia did. Like, that was the emphasis on the Latvians, on policy analysis and impact assessment, to support the individual laws. And they introduced that here. And I guess they did it in a way that there were too many, and it became kind of a technocratic document. It never resonated at the decision-making level, and it kind of died out. So that was a big change, but one that didn't really work. Mm-hmm. And it's one they're trying to revive again now. And I consider that actually a big positive, that you know, they go back to problems and try to solve them again. Because again, to me, that's a sign in any government of sort of a healthy system, is where you know, you don't just throw things away. You continually try to work at it and continually try to improve.
Hmm. Was the basic impact assessment introduced in 2003, was that something that you worked on as well?
A little bit. Like, it was just the end of the project, so we worked on and said, this is how it could work. These are, you know, we gave them some examples of, here's some sort of formats that work countries. The big challenge here, though, was because there's so many laws that come forward, is how do you decide which laws to pick and that kind of thing. And I guess I suspect that's the part that never worked, because it became sort of a routine exercise where they would attach them to, you know, 150 or 200 laws or something, and the politicians just were overwhelmed by it, perhaps. I mean, I don't know, I wasn't here, but you know, I don't think they ever figure out a way to get a manageable number of these assessments and have them used as a decision-making tool.
Mm-hmm. If I could take it back actually for a minute about the question, the issue of the legislative backlog, the priority perhaps EU legislation. Mm-hmm. That how did you actually intervene on that level? Were there officials in the Prime Minister's office? Was there a process of identifying priority legislation, and then somehow instructing ministries or instructing Parliament to accelerate? How does that actually work?
But, yeah, I mean, what they did, I mean, the delays were at the government level initially, and so I mean, it was taking, you know, they had an annual plan, and they had a target date of, say, March for this important law, and it wouldn't come till October. So what they did is they just started more actively managing their legislative plan. And there's two organizations that made a particular effort to do this. One was the Chancellery and Prime Minister's Office, and then the other was the European Committee, which was the organization that was coordinating the effort to the European integration across government. And they were very significant, and I should mention this earlier, they were a very, very significant player in this whole process. In fact, going back, their support was one of the critical success factors that made this thing work. Because in those early years, they were arguing across governments and to Brussels that they saw this planning system as something that was helping them and helping Lithuania sort of move its European agenda along. So I think that's an important point to add there. So you had sort of, in a sense, two central institutions both pushing to make sure the important laws got through. Once they got to the Parliament, I think the Parliament, you were able to negotiate with Parliament that these were important laws. It was getting them out of the ministries and into the government that was the challenge when we were sort of first measuring the problems.
Mm-hmm. But certainly some legislation important for EU accession would be introduced by Parliament themselves. Is that accurate, or?
I doubt it. And the reason being is to get into Europe, there's this thing called the acquis, which is 110,000 pages legislation, and then there's also a legislation approximation, and then there's so there's a whole series of laws that have to go through. The EU in those days would work out an annual and a three-term plan with each government that would be pages and pages and pages. So, but it was with the government, in a sense, that was worked out. So I think it was probably the government that was producing 99% of these laws. Mm-hmm. Because, there's a very, in a sense, a timetable and a schedule to do it that they, agreed with the EU.
Do you recall any resistance from Parliament in terms of trying to dictate the pace of the adoption of legislation or the sequencing of discussions?
Nothing really, no real problems. I think there's always a tension here with Parliament concerning the volume of legislation because they just can't possibly process it all. And it remains a problem to this day. Is there something like, 200 or 300 laws in the parliamentary backlog right now? Now, of course, that would be 10 years worth of legislation in Canada, but 450 years of legislation in the United States since you only pass about one a year now. That's about 3 years worth of legislation in Lithuania, so that it's not quite as bad. But yeah, so the tension there was the other dynamic in Lithuania was between the president and the government, and that's just it's a cabinet system here. It's not quite like it's not semi-presidential. The president does have influence, and occasionally the president would, who is sort of seen as more revered by the people in a sense, occasionally the president would criticize the government about this issue or that issue. So, and that, that was more of a dynamic.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask you. So you the project expired in 2003, and then you returned several years later in 2007. Why were you brought back in 2007?
Well, I was just I was here with some Serbians because the Lithuanian Latvia to some degree became interesting models for other EU accession countries to look at. And so I was here with a group of Serbians who were sort of on a study tour to Latvia and Lithuania. And while I was here, someone in the Prime Minister's office came up and asked me if I'd be interested in working with them on, they were sort of taking a look again at sort of revitalizing their system. They'd felt that it sort of slipped off and, as happens in every country, sort of become more technocratic, become disconnected from decision making. They were looking at revitalizing it, and would I be interested in helping them? And I said, yeah, sure. And so, I went through some, the typical, so-called competitive process that they run, and at some point they told me, okay, so you come over now. And then so I started working with them from about, I think, late 2009 on, something like that. Mm-hmm.
So what was the situation in 2009? We've discussed a little bit some of the ways that the reforms stagnated, became too bureaucratic.
Yeah, that's the perception. Again, I wasn't here there, and of course, remember that an incoming government will always, critique the previous period, because they want to be the ones to make a change. But That aside, I suspect there's a certain amount of truth. I mean, in every government, remember Brazos's government had been re-elected, so they were in power for 6 years. You know, there's a certain reform fatigue sets in, a certain comfort with, you know, their own way of doing things. So, you know, processes do tend to become more technocratic. Decision-making becomes a little more lax because there's just sort of a, you know, there's not the same familiarity and tension. The economic climate was pretty good in the late 2000s, and, you know, so I suspect all that was true. But, of course, in 2009, Europe was in the beginning of this horrendous fiscal challenge, and again, with Kubilius as the prime minister again, they felt there was an urgency to quickly, in a sense, sharpen their planning system. But also, as you can see, they're introducing a lot more tools now. They've gone beyond strategic planning. I mean, they're looking at human resources management, performance management issues, evaluation. Like, you know, slowly over the years, they're adding the full gamut of these instruments that OECD governments have. I mean, I'm telling you, they're getting near the complete set at this point, but there's still a few to go. Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned that perhaps they're trying to do too much?
They probably are. In a sense, but in the end, is that going to be a problem? I mean, the whole issue will be of these various tools that they put in place over the last few years, which ones survive a transition? And I'm reasonably confident that a good number of them will, and that if a new government comes in next year, they'll pick up the ones that suit them and continue the process. I mean, it's not as though there's as I said, this is the reform. This type of reform is a linear process with an obvious endpoint. It's more of a choreography in some sense. And I think that the basic underlying principles, which have become a little more sophisticated over the years, will continue. Of things like the political interaction with the process, extending it to the whole concept of performance, having better results measures, extending it to evaluation of senior management, all those kinds of things will ultimately continue under the next government. So, no, not all of them will survive, but that's fine.
In the past couple of years, have you been working on specific instruments, or looking at the system as a whole?
Yeah, I look at all of them, four of them. In this particular area, I mean, they've been introducing functional reviews, they've been introducing program evaluations, they've introduced an IT system to monitor results, they're introducing impact assessments. I mean, those are probably the major things I've looked at. Mm-hmm. Oh, and now they're looking at capability reviews. Mm-hmm.
So I understand the IT monitoring tool has been relatively well received.
It's in place now. It'll start producing its first quarterly reports next year. So April will be the first one. So it's just there. And
can you explain a bit how that's supposed to work?
Yeah, I mean, what it is it's got sort of, I think, two elements to it. I mean, probably I could give you a better answer, but basically, it has measures that track the government's priorities, which the Prime Minister's office cares about. And again, they've put an effort into coming up with, better results measures. I mean, every country can always improve these things, but they actually do some tangible ones here now that makes some sense. And then there's a level of ministry measures, which are related more to the ministry strategic plans, which the ministries track. So, in a sense, there's things that are of use to the Prime Minister's office and things that are of use to the ministry. And I think, they're probably, in the classic sort of, there's both outputs and outcomes as part of it. But the idea is it's all there, and then they can quickly link it to priorities or not, the ministry strategic plans or not. And, and over time, they'll build a longitudinal view of how, like, road safety is progressing, whatever the indicators they are for use for that, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
So as of now, the outputs aren't directly linked to the outputs in the strategic plans?
As of now, I mean, they put them in the strategic plans, but I guess they've, I mean, I think now the difference is they have what they believe will be a good MIS to support it. I mean, they've been producing results reports for years, but you know, what do people do with paper reports or you know charts that are on you know in Word on, or Excel on someone's computer? I mean, this is the idea here now is it's a system that can you know will also archive information and so it's just they've been doing it for a while, but it's just more accessible now.
Mm-hmm. I understand there's also a mechanism as part of the system to alert ministries or the Prime Minister's office if a project is behind schedule.
Yeah, I think that's a separate system. I think we're talking about in structural funding. Oh, and they have a project. In both structural funding area and then they have a project management area. This is a module, and again, ask Agley about this, but. And that's more of a classic project management software that tracks steps in implementing something. And so, you know, you see if you're falling behind. I mean, it's you know, classical sort of critical path or PERT thing put onto software. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they have that type of thing to it.
Okay, but that's a separate tool.
It's a separate module.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, but also being monitored by the Prime Minister's office?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you a bit your impression of the project evaluation tool in place? I understand they've had a couple of pilot evaluations. Program evaluation, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's probably a sensible tool. I mean, in a lot of countries, you know, you have cycles where you say you're going to evaluate every program every 5 years or something like that. And like say, you know, from Canada, you set up evaluation units in each ministry, and you know they contract out some consultants, and you know they do you know these various evaluations, which are then fed back into the system. It's questionable, you know, how well that's worked even in the developed countries. So recognizing that evaluation is one of those things in government that everyone knows you should do, but almost every government does it badly. They're also trying to attempt it here, but they're doing a more internal approach where you're going to create evaluation teams with ministry people, perhaps with an external consultant, but with also people from Ministry of Finance and Prime Minister's office on the team to help evaluate the programs. This is probably sensible for Lithuania because it's much cheaper than spending, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 on a consultant. And, you know, it has the potential to lead to, I guess, modest improvements. Like, it's not going to revolutionize things. But it seems like a sensible approach. They're going to come up with an annual plan, identify a certain number of programs to be evaluated each year. The government will approve it, and then the ministries will go about doing it. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a bit about the functional reviews?
Yeah.
Now, is this separate from the activities of the Sunset Commission?
Well, no, I mean, the Sunset Commission, in a sense, has its finger in all these pies. And in fact, that may be the way it evolves. But the Sunset Commission has always been involved in the organization of government. And so it has had close involvement in the functional review program, unlike program evaluation. So in that sense, I mean, there's going to be a functional review, same as the program evaluation, there's going to be a functional review plan. Several will be identified. It'll be delivered by a core group of ministry people, supported by a Ministry of Interior, in this case, and the Prime Minister's office. And they'll look at functions that are agencies or parts of ministries that have been identified as where they'd like to actually take a look at the structure of it. It has a chance of being somewhat effective, but it's worth recalling that big functional reviews in Eastern Europe, where they've been done everywhere, have been notoriously unsuccessful. Probably because of they've been overambitious in their design, and they've been imposed by donors, and they've been part, you know, all that kind of thing. But this one, I think, has a chance of producing some modest improvements, just because it's less ambitious and sort of more, you know, it's more internally delivered than having some, you know, paying $500,000 to some consultants to come up with a grand design for a new ministry or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Is it looking for overlapping functions or gaps? What is the aim?
I mean, you know, it depends what your target is, but it just gives some examples. If they look at, you know, they can do a horizontal review where they look at sort of the inspection functions across government, and, you know, if you have 28 different inspection functions, can you consolidate them into four? You know, they might look at that. If they look at an agency, in the agency's case, they might be looking for, does it overlap with other agencies? Is this an agency that could be commercialized or privatized? Or is this an agency that just has overlapping functions that could be made more efficient? And again, in the sort of traditional functional reviews, big decisions like divesting, eliminating the agency are rarely ones that are ever made. I suspect these things would be more along the lines of making things more efficient, streamlining them a bit.
And they've already had some successes in terms of a lot of successes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't remember the specific results, but they worked with a number of ministries, and some of the ministries have made a few changes as a result of it. So this is not like any kind of radical restructuring of government, but it falls more into that rubric of, continuous improvement, slight efficiency gains, similar to program evaluations in that sense.
Okay, I understand that there's been an effort to reduce the number of budget programs, the number of appropriation managers. Is that part of this process as well, of streamlining government activities?
Or? Sure. It wasn't done as so much as a result of a functional review, but I believe earlier in the government's mandate, probably in 2009, they had this problem of, an appropriation manager is someone with independent budget responsibility, therefore an independent budget, therefore a separate strategic plan. They had way too many, which meant that certainly things that would be normally parts of ministries were sort of quasi-independent from ministries. So I don't know if they cut them in half or whatever, but they radically reduced the number of appropriation managers and folded them under ministries. So in a sense, they had sort of less plans to deal with, less budget things to deal with. They also moved out a whole lot of agencies that reported just to the government, but to no one really, and moved them under ministries, made them subordinate. So those were two ways in which they sort of tried to rationalize the their proliferation of agencies. I think they have 700 agencies here or something like that.
Mm-hmm. They also changed the strategic planning process. The Ministry of Finance issued budget ceilings earlier in the process and then asked ministries to develop their strategic plans, explain how they're going to use those resources. I understand they've somewhat switched the order in that process. Can you describe some of the... Were you involved in that switch?
No, not really. No, that happened by the time I got here. But again, sort of, if you think of this evolution of things, I mean, there was sort of a two-step process in the early days where there's priority setting, macro framework, then you set the ceilings, then you develop the plans. Over time, the priority setting became kind of pro forma, and you really went back to having ceilings set, and then you would negotiate the plans, but you sort of would redo the ceilings as per the Prime Minister's wishes in the middle of the process. But, it became a little muddier, and that was fine. But the Prime Minister was still involved in plans, because that was his route to, affecting what ministries were doing. When Camillus got back in again, they reintroduced a priority setting phase. It's not the same as the one previously, but since there's such an emphasis on priorities now, and they're tracked by the Prime Minister's office, and I think they feel they more or less have a handle on this, they decided at the same time that rather than have these detailed strategic plans come for approval, they would just focus on this priority part and then let the ministries, in a sense, do their own plans. So the plans become more like operational plans delivering the priorities than they do, strategic plans in a sense. So, there's no perfect system. It probably makes sense for them to do something like that. Now, ministries have had enough years of experience working on this to develop these things on their own. And I think, talk to Egli about this, ask her, but I think they've had feedback from the ministries that although they opposed this at first, they saw it as somehow a lessening of their influence as strategic planners and ministries. They've come around to support it more. Like they've started to see that it actually gives them more flexibility, which gets back to one of your earlier questions.
Hmm. Wait, there's one more area I'd like to ask you about, and that is the reintroduction or the revitalization of the impact assessment tool. What are some of the changes that the government's trying to make in that area?
The changes are, the one big change is that there's going to be less of them. And again, you know, probably the problem was before is that they had said, you know, any significant law will be evaluated. Well, there's so many laws here that, you know, we probably had like, what, had hundreds of, you know, a couple hundred evaluations. So what they're doing here is now, as part of the legislative planning process, on an annual basis, they put together all the legislation that's going to be going to the parliament. You know, they put it in an annual plan and so set due dates. As part of that process, they're going to pick, you know, who knows, let's say 20 to 30 major laws that are coming forward. The selection of those laws will be a debate between the Prime Minister's Office and ministries. Like, ministries may suggest some, Prime Minister's Office may suggest some. They'll come up with a list, present it to the government, and then, you know, agree on it. So everyone knows, government's bought in, they've identified the 20 laws or 30 laws that are going to come forward. Ministries then know what they have to do, and the Prime Minister's Office will, at least in the first year, work closely with ministries on producing the assessments. And so, you know, during the year, maybe two a month, three a month will come forward, and they'll give much more closer scrutiny to that. So they're hoping by focusing on really big laws and controlling the volume, that will create a political demand for this type of information as a key to decision making. And that's the whole key. Like, if they don't use it for decision making, then it's pointless. But you think about it from the decision maker's perspective, what's the difference? Let's say there's going to be a big change in the energy sector or something like that. The way it is now is the ministry will bring forward three or four laws, you know, that may be 100 pages each, to change the energy sector. The ministers are sitting in their cabinet, they get these laws, they haven't got a clue what they're about. There's a little two-page explanatory note, and they kind of look at it, and they'll, you know, maybe the Prime Minister will have been briefed, but they have to ask questions based on these huge laws. You know, and it's very, very difficult. There's no real collective decision-making process. It more or less depends on whoever the minister is responsible for energy to come up with the right ideas. In a policy-driven system, where these sort of policy documents or impact assessments come forward, it'll say, here's two or three options that we could pursue for the energy sector. Here's the respective impacts of each and costs of each of these options. This is the one we recommend. We've done some consultations out with stakeholders. Here's the likely reaction you're going to get. Here's some of the key elements of each model. Which one do you want to pursue? Then the government looks at it, and they can actually have a debate around that type of formulation of problems. And once they've made that decision, then you can go and draft your 400 pages legislation. So it's kind of like a two-step process, and but that's a big culture change. But they're hoping to succeed this time by limiting the volume, focusing on important things, and producing higher quality documents. Will it work? Who knows?
Have they begun to introduce the impact assessments?
Not really. I think they've done some sort of tests on them, but they're just at the plan. They're planning their legislative agenda now, so they'll be identifying the 20 to 30 over the next few weeks, and then they'll start actually arriving probably in April, May, sometime around then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for sharing your thoughts. Looking back on 14 years of work in Lithuania, is there something you know now you wish you knew back then at the beginning of the process? Some advice you'd like to give?
No, I wouldn't. You know, in a weird kind of way, and you know, I can think of all sorts of things. But in a way, I'm glad I didn't know it. I mean, it was just I just simply enjoyed evolving with them along the way. That was sort of, it was more their journey, and I was happy to come along for the ride. So, you know, I don't think I don't really question the way it happened. I'm just, you know, was glad to be part of it.
Oh, thank you so much for your time.